Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
The world is facing a shortage of tradespeople. The metaverse can help solve that problem. With a virtual reality training platform, developed by ForgeFX, aspiring welders can practice over and over. As a result, students learn the specialized skills they need to begin and advance welding careers. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
I'm Katya Adler from the Global Story podcast, and we're looking at this summer's Paris Olympics and Paralympics. Hosting the Games put a lot of pressure on a city. This means hosting isn't quite as appealing as it once used to be. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Richard Kagoy, and on this edition of Focus on Africa, the DR Congo issues a warning against big tech companies. What's the warning and what's the response? Also, we speak to the Afrobeats artist Ira Starr about her journey and what she thinks about how women are doing in the art form.
You know, it took a long time for us to get here, but we are here now. We have young girls in Afrobeats, we have women in African music just to the world, and it's amazing. It's like, give me all the recognition, give me my flowers. And I feel like there's been so many women that have worked hard for this moment now, and we now are kind of reaping the benefits of all their hard work. It's not where it's supposed to be yet, trust me. It's supposed to be way more than this, but it's going somewhere.
It's Friday, April 26th. A Human Rights Watch report alleges that more than 220 civilians, including at least 56 children, were massacred by Burkina Faso's military in a single day this year. They say the attacks took place on the 25th of February when the army killed 179 people in Soro village and 44 others in the nearby Nondin village following an investigation by their teams on the ground. Human Rights Watch termed the mass killings among the worst army abuse incidents in the country in nearly a decade. Burkinabe authorities have not commented on this report. Now, last month, one of Burkina Faso's public prosecutors, Ali Benjamin Koulibaly, appealed for witnesses to identify the group behind the mass killings. He had, at the time, put the preliminary death toll at 170 people. For more of the Human Rights Watch report, I've been speaking to the director of advocacy at the organization, Philippe Dalm.
Indeed, more than 200 civilians killed in just a few hours is extremely shocking. But, you know, it's been part of a pattern of human rights violations that we've been seeing in Burkina Faso. Killings and summary executions by the Burkina Faso military or the VDP, the Volunteers pour la Défense de la Patrie, Volunteers for the Defense of Homeland, which are basically militias, or also exactions and killings committed by Islamist armed groups. But the numbers here and the intensity of the violence that civilians face is really shocking and must be fully investigated indeed.
So who's really behind this massacre?
What we found, and we talked to a number of survivors and direct witness of what happened, and what they told us is that those crimes were committed by the special force of the Burkina Faso army. And what happened is, well, there was a wave of attacks by Islamist armed groups in the days preceding that attack. And it looks like a convoy of those groups passed at proximity of the village. And military forces came half an hour in the first village or one more hour later in the second village and basically stopped there. And instead of continuing the counterterrorism operation, what happened is that they stopped there and started gathering civilians. And while seeing that among the people who were in this village, there were only civilians, many of them being women or even children, because we counted up to at least 50 children being among the dead. Well, they gathered people, separated them by gender or age, and they started shooting at them deliberately, summarily. And that's why to us it looks like it's an exaction which came as a reprisal against civilians, accusing them of collaborating with Islamist armed groups, while the reality to us is that civilians are really in the middle of two actors who have been putting them in the middle, and they are suffering from crimes committed from both sides. So for a long time, we've been commenting that those crimes, because of their deliberate nature, were likely war crimes, given their systematic nature. And after this massive massacre, we are calling it possible crimes against humanity. And that's because it reached another level of gravity and of systematic nature, and that very much deserves a full and independent investigation.
How do we know that this is the army, you know, the special forces that you have cited? Is there any evidence to suggest that?
Well, we've seen evidences of the consequence of the crimes, right? Piles of bodies. We've seen mass graves in one of the two villages. And we've, in fact, collected very consistent testimonies from witnesses and survivors. And the reality is that the survivors, you know, because they're in a state of shock, what they say is analyzed very carefully by our colleagues. And the level of consistency is so clear that for us, it's very likely that the armed force are to be investigated. Civilians pointed at details like how troops look like. They pointed at particular forms of troops, basically the rapid intervention battalion, bataillon d'intervention rapide, which are special forces within the army. And that level of consistency can only indicate that it's very likely it is them. Civilians also went to the regional police and filed complaints. The reality is that they have been largely ignored so far. A local prosecutor went on the ground and even failed to indicate that he saw the number of victims or traces of the victims, which may indicate that it's rather a cover-up rather than a proper investigation. And the fact that public statements or statements from public media have only pointed out at exactions committed by Islamist armed groups without indicating the level of gravity of crimes that we have documented really pointed the need to really dig into what happened and increase the likelihood that Burkina Faso forces are incriminated in those crimes.
You know, it's a very delicate issue, very, very sensitive. I wonder how you went about information gathering, like in this case, identifying, you know, witnesses. Did they openly talk about it?
You know, it took us months, weeks and months to come through this investigation. And therefore, it had took us some time to identify how to find the victims, how to find the survivors. We do not work in a vacuum. And even though we ourselves don't have physical access because of the security and the political situation, we continue to work closely with people who are really integrated on the ground, civil society groups and others. And we've talked to them to help us identify the victims. You know, the reality is that investigations of that sort are not the first in the context of Burkina Faso. We've published quite a few reports on exactions committed both by Islamist armed groups and by the military. No later than the second half of last year, we documented a number of drone strikes, which have led a large number of civilian deaths, at least 16 in the three cases we documented, drones which are certainly some of the most precise weapons. But the fact that they have reached civilians shows that there was either a lack of precaution or a deliberate targeting of civilians. So this is part of a pattern. Right. And this is also part of the pattern that authorities have failed to investigate very serious allegations. And what we're saying is that there have been crimes committed by the army, but there is definitely a wave of impunity. And it's really the responsibility of the Burkina Faso authorities to seriously investigate those crimes because they are extremely grave. And because we have doubts on the independence of a domestic investigation only, we really insist on the need to ensure that there are African Union or United Nations experts participating in this investigation to secure its impartiality and independence.
And in terms of verifying, you know, the information that you have gathered, how did you go about it? Was there even use of technology, maybe even to verify, you know, some of these claims?
Right. So we have used different sources. And, you know, the core sources that we use are, of course, the voices and the testimonies of the survivors and victims. But we have cross-checked that with other forms of evidence, photos and videos, which we have independently authentified are, of course, another important category of evidence. It proved that the crimes happened. It proved us that there were piles of bodies and there were bodies in the morgue. We have also used satellite images, which in the particular in the village of Soro, one of the two villages affected by these killings, have helped us to identify the exact location of a number of mass graves, right? Corroborating once again the testimony that we have received and the videos and photos that we have been able to see. So, you know, that's different sources, different material that we've been using, which all point in the same direction. There was a massive crime in two villages, and they all point at the involvement of special forces.
And are these crimes just happening in that specific area of the country to the north? It's a common occurrence in other parts of the country.
Exactly, and that's extremely shocking and sad to see the number of crimes committed almost every day, definitely every week in the country. And again, you know, this particular report points at the responsibility of Burkina Faso's armed forces. In a number of other reports we published in the past year, we pointed at the responsibilities of those militias, which lack complete oversight and, you know, which operate in almost complete impunity. But in other reports, we have also documented such crimes in, you know, killing multiple civilians, large number of civilians committed by Islamist armed groups. So it is, you know, the reality that civilians are trapped and abandoned. And unfortunately, the conflict in Burkina Faso and to a certain extent, the other conflict in Mali is more and more forgotten by regional and international media, but also the regional and international community. And the more civilians are ignored, the more they suffer.
Would you say that the security situation there has worsened since the exit of the U.S. troops and, you know, the lives of citizens are more at risk because of their departure?
Look, as I said, we think that the lack of international attention creates a space for impunity. And yes, the less attention there is from other regional actors, the less capacity of international organizations to operate, the more the rest of the world is looking elsewhere, the more civilians are at risk. So it's really essential to reverse that dynamic and ensure that there is a united global voice coming from African and international leaders to remind the authorities that they have a responsibility to protect civilians, that they cannot argue that the fight against extremist violence is justifying any of the killings of civilians, and that they can get away from it without investigating those crimes and those allegations. The role of the army is to protect civilians. You know, they have the right and, in fact, the duty to combat extremist violent groups because those groups are also attacking civilians, but they also have a duty to save lives and to investigate when there are serious allegations of abuses, and they don't do that. And I think it's important that the message be clear that impunity cannot be, you know, the core of the present and the future of a country like Burkina Faso.
Have you presented these findings to the Burkinabe government? Has there been a reaction to this?
So I haven't seen a reaction to this very specific report of ours today, but we have indeed shared previous reports with the authorities. And in fact, the Burkina Faso authorities have reacted to some of the first expressions of concerns following the crime in late February. In particular, if I'm correct, the defense minister who simply, in fact, around those dates, pointed at the attacks by Islamist armed groups, which preceded this massacre of civilians, which I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation. There was also a statement by a local prosecutor who said that an investigation was open and that he went on the site, but has failed to confirm that he could see any body of dead civilian, which, you know, raises question about how this investigation took even place. There were also statements, well, or rather reports from the National Burkina Television, which simply failed to comment on what happened in those two villages, failing to make any reference to civilian victims, while pointing at a drone was at the beginning of the operation following the special forces, but then left them operate, which indicate that could have been a willingness to prevent any recording of what happened following the beginning of the operation. So, you know, that consistent failure to acknowledge that civilians were killed en masse in such large numbers and refusal to engage into a credible process of inquiry is something which raises serious concern. And, you know, the words of the government, we shouldn't stop there. And there should be consistent effort to push for and none of those violations. And again, effort to really confront impunity.
All right, Philippe Dam, thank you so much for coming to the podcast.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Philippe Dam from Human Rights Watch. Just to reiterate that the Burkinabe government are yet to respond to the report by Human Rights Watch. Our BBC team has contacted the government for a right of reply, and the Director of Communications of the Army said he'll get back to our BBC team when and if they make a statement. Also, supporters of the military junta have previously criticized the media for reporting alleged atrocities, saying that the reporting is designed to hit the morale of the Burkina Faso armed forces. We have since learned that the BBC and Human Rights Watch have been suspended from Burkina Faso for the next 2 weeks. You may have spotted our next story online, where the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo is accusing technology companies like Apple of using minerals that have been illegally mined from eastern DRC, an area riddled by years of armed conflict. The DRC, through a group of lawyers, says it has written to Apple expressing fears that the company's supply chain is tainted by blood minerals from the country. Now, the DRC is rich in tin, tungsten, tantalum, and gold, also known as 3TG minerals, which are used to make smartphones and other electronic devices. The country's leadership believes big technology multinationals like Apple have benefited from these minerals mined in rebel-controlled territories of the expansive country and traded illegally through DRC's neighbor, Rwanda. To understand DRC's grievances, we are speaking to Robert Amsterdam. He is the lead lawyer representing the Congolese government.
They're very simple. It's basically cease and desist from taking minerals that are improperly labeled and not doing the due diligence necessary to ensure that the DRC receives the value it should from the minerals that are being extracted.
You've called them blood minerals. What does that mean in the context?
What's going on in the Eastern Congo and what's going on with the assistance of Rwanda and M23 has resulted in the loss of lives of millions and millions of people. And this would not be going on were there not at the base of it a profit-making business. And that business involves the extraction of minerals in rebel-held territory, the involvement of Rwanda in supporting M23 and extracting these minerals, and the fact that companies such as Apple are purchasing the results of these minerals from intermediaries who may improperly be labeling and sourcing these goods in a way that is further providing material assistance and monies to those in control of these rebel areas.
You've mentioned Rwanda there, and you know, we've engaged them on this podcast previously, and what they have said is they have no links, they're not involved with what's happening in Eastern DRC, and they have denied, you know, backing the M23 rebel group.
Well, listen, if I were them, I would deny all of that, too. The fact of the matter is, child in high school can tell you that Rwanda does not possess the minerals that Western companies seem to pretend they are mining. In fact, the EU has done a deal with Rwanda to expand their Rwandan sourcing, while all of us know that Rwanda doesn't have those minerals. So I call it eyes wide shut. I call it the big lie. Let's be very clear. The UN has censured Rwanda. The United States has censured Rwanda. Rwanda knows very well what it's doing. What is amazing and outrageous is that such a large part of the Rwandan economy is based on donor money, and those donors are not asking questions, just like companies aren't asking questions, and we have to put a stop to it. The Rwandans are ultimately accountable for their actions and their conduct, as are these Western companies, and the DRC is standing up, finally, as are many African countries, to try to block these bogus supply chains and reassert their sovereignty and demand that their people get the benefit of the minerals that are under their feet.
And why is the DRC making this decision right now? Talk to me about the timing.
Look, there are many reasons. One, of course, has been the successful re-election of its president. Secondly, of course, the ongoing hemorrhage in terms of blood and people in the Eastern Congo. And then lastly, in terms of exactly today, there is a meeting scheduled in the next few days, a state visit by the leader of the DRC. And I'm sure he will be raising with President Macron many of these issues. We've just witnessed the EU signing a new deal with Rwanda. And I believe the president will absolutely take the opportunity to question how any deal can be set up between the EU and Rwanda respecting minerals, given Rwanda's actual behavior, given the documented evidence about what Rwanda's doing with M23.
So is it just Apple Inc. That's just benefiting from the minerals extracted from the conflict
absolutely
zones
not.
That you meant?
Absolutely not. It's many companies. Apple is a great company. Apple is a company that's leader says that they make the hard choices in favor of doing what's right. And we're going to take Apple at its word, and we're going to hope that Apple might be a moral leader in terms of doing what's right when it comes to the DRC.
Any specific steps that you would expect companies such as Apple and the rest that you say have benefited from this business? What is expected of them next? What do you want them to do?
I would say the first thing would be to have meetings with government representatives and discuss supply chain management. And I think we need to understand what's been going on. I think, you know, the term would be to open the books and review sourcing methodologies and take steps from there. But I think companies such as Apple should simply comply with the reasonable requests of the DRC and move forward.
I wonder, in the extractive world, is there a sort of like international standard or mechanism that is used to remove, you know, blood minerals from the supply chain and just make sure that they don't end up in the market?
There have been a number of them. Unfortunately, as the Global Witness Report made clear, many of them are flawed. Many of them have been instrumentalized by companies to essentially launder their activities. So there needs to be a new sheriff put in town to make sure that the DRC is protected.
And in DRC, is that mechanism not working, and why is it not?
Again, there's been a massive report that's been put out by Global Witness. There are many reasons for it, but it will take a lot more time than we have today to try to go through it. Bag and tag programs simply haven't been working, and it is not impossible for them to function, but there's a tremendous amount that has to be reconfigured. And of course, one of the key issues is the support of Rwanda for its mineral laundering. That's got to stop.
All right, Robert, we have to leave it there for now, but really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. That's Robert Amsterdam, the lead lawyer representing the DRC. The BBC has reached out to Apple for a response, and they referred us to their conflict minerals report. It says, based on our due diligence efforts, including analyzing the information provided by third-party audit programs, upstream traceability programs, and our suppliers, we found no reasonable basis for concluding that any of the smelters or refiners of 3TG determined to be in our supply chain as of December 31st, 2023, directly or indirectly financed or benefited armed groups in the DRC or an adjoining country. Let me also add that the government of Rwanda has also strongly denied any links with the M23 rebel group in eastern DRC. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
Cataracts are the world's leading cause of avoidable blindness. The metaverse can help address that problem. A virtual reality platform created by Fundamental VR and Orbis International helps train doctors to treat cataracts, resulting in more confident surgeons operating all over the world. With virtual reality training, surgeons can practice over and over to gain skills. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast, and we're looking at this summer's Paris Olympics and Paralympics. Hosting the Games puts a lot of pressure on a city. This means hosting isn't quite as appealing as it once used to be. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Richard Kagoe.
I just finished my album. My second album.
What's it called?
It's called The Year I Turned 21.
Is it autobiographical?
Yes. A diary, literally, of my experiences of 21. And I can't wait to share it with the world.
This is Oyinkanshola Sarah Aderibije, popularly known as Ira Star, a 21-year-old Nigerian female Afrobeats artist who rapidly became one of Africa's biggest stars in the space of 3 years. Ira gained mainstream recognition after songs like Bloody Samaritan in 2021. Then, in 2022, the release of Rush, which led her to her first Grammy nomination and making BBC's Sound of 2024. Ira is a star indeed, and her latest single is Commas, that has spent 5 weeks on top of the UK Afrobeats chart and surpassed 25 million Spotify plays. Ira's new album is set for release in May. And most recently, she met a female icon, Rihanna, and she'll be opening for Chris Brown on his massive North American tour later this summer. Collaboration may well be the key of all things possible. Ira and my colleague Audrey Brown spoke about many things, but first, she talked about her new album, The Year I Turned 21.
I feel like now I've experienced, you know, having patience and how like everything happens the way it's supposed to be, and just continuous like faith in God and allowing him do his work and just living in the presence. And I feel like with this album, I gave myself to this project. Oh, like it's real. It's real stories and it's things people can be able to relate to.
Right.
And it's just musical genius.
Even if you say so yourself. Well, I must tell you about the learning about everything in divine right time and the patience.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't learned that yet, and I'm way, way, way older than you, so congratulations.
Thank you.
You are one of the few very, very prominent women in Afrobeats. Why do you think that is? Is it because the industry doesn't make space for you, or is it because women don't want to be involved in the industry? Because the music industry is kind of tricky.
Yeah. I feel like the art is a big representation of our culture in general. And I feel like what it is now, women in Afrobeats are taking over. You know, it took a long time for us to get here, but we are here now. And I feel like it's the perfect time. 2024, 2025. We have young girls in Afrobeats. We have women in African music just to the world. And it's amazing.
Why do you think this is the tipping point? What was it that brought the industry to this kind of... Is it recognition that women are getting? Or is it recognition that they are grabbing?
I think it's definitely recognition that they are grabbing. It's like, give me all the recognition. Give me my flowers. And I feel like there's been so many women that have worked hard for this moment now. And we now are kind of reaping the benefits of all their hard work. It's not where it's supposed to be yet, trust me. It's supposed to be way more than this, but it's going somewhere.
What do you think women need to succeed in the industry? It's not just the music industry. It's in general. There are ways in which people, you know, mental health can be broken down because of social media, or just because, you know, it's a tough industry and you actually really need to kind of be tough yourself.
Yes.
What are the tools that you have, do you think, that make it possible for you to succeed?
First of all, I have a lot of support. And I feel like that is one of my strongest points. I'm not really led astray because I know what I'm here for and I know what I'm going to do. And I do have a lot of support from women from the industry also.
I was going to ask you that. The kind of idea out there is that women compete negatively with each other.
No, it's the most beautiful thing. I have a lot of support from women from the industry and people I looked up to and people that I'm looking up to that inspire me. Like, I get advice from them. I give advice. Young girls that are coming, I follow and I'm like, you're doing this, do this. Like, we're just supporting each other and it's so beautiful.
So who would you say are your musical ancestors?
Rihanna.
And you're going to be working with her? We're going to be talking
shit. Amen. Rihanna is my number one. She's been my number one. I grew up listening to her. You know, there's Tiwa Savage, there's Simi. Now we have Thames. I grew up listening to the Lijadu sisters.
Lijadu.
Yeah, Asha.
They're all Nigerian women, though. Well, besides Rihanna.
Angelique Kidjo.
Okay.
She's Beninese, okay?
Yeah, basically Nigerian. Oh, no, she would hate it if I said that. I shouldn't say that.
Now, you said there's no competition between women in the industry.
Yes.
But there is competition between countries in the industry. It had to come up. South Africa, Nigeria. Which brings me to collaborations. A few years ago, there was a lot of talk of collaboration. Mm-hmm. There were lots of collaborations, people sharing stages with major stars in the UK and in US. And at the time when it started, it felt like, you know, the major stars in the UK and the US were kind of like allowing these young people onto the stage. Mm-hmm. But that's changing now, right? It's actually equals.
Yes.
So talk to me about your collaborations.
Well, start with Rihanna. There's no collaboration yet.
Yet. We're talking it into existence.
Into existence, by God's grace. I love collaborations because I feel like that's the best way, especially when you're collaborating with people from like other countries, learn about that culture and like, you know, tap into that culture and that side of the world. I collaborated a lot last year.
Tell us about your collaborations from last year.
I did a lot of features. I had a song from Kenya with Bian. I had a song with my brother, Crayon Ngozi. We did so amazing. I had Leanne from the UK with me. Makes me a UK girl now. I just need my passport.
Did you collaborate with Stormzy?
Yes, I did.
And you're opening on tour for Chris Brown, right?
Yes. Yes.
Tell me about that.
I'm so excited.
Is that where you're going to the US for?
Yes, I'm going there just to rehearse, get ready, get my body ready, get my mind ready for that.
Okay. Now, you know, there was a lot of wahala about Chris Brown and Rihanna, you know, assault charges and a history of hitting women and so on. How do you square that?
Wow. That question.
You have thought about it, haven't you?
I have, kind of. I have, in a way, because Rihanna is my queen. But, like, I try to just, you know, separate, like, work.
But, I mean, if people know about it, you do know that they're going to come for you. Are you prepared for it?
I'm prepared. I'm ready. But I have the love of Rihanna supporting me. She gave me all the advice, all the best advice in the world. And I know that I have
so she know, she knew about this, about the
I don't know if she knows. I don't know. I don't know yet.
It's worth us talking about it a little bit, right? Because it also goes to your credibility, what people would say about you. And if they're wondering whether, did you think about it or did it come up in any of the negotiations, the discussions, you know, I'm sure that it probably didn't. But in terms of how you would respond when people do come for you, what would you tell them?
I won't respond. I'll let people do their thing, and I'm just gonna work.
How do you manage your image and your brand? What would you say it is?
My brand is Africa's sweetheart, princess of Afrobeats and African music. And I feel like my brand is just positivity and like love.
You're not just a musician, right? Mm-hmm. You're also involved in initiatives that speak to some of the gaps that we have on the continent, clean water specifically. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
I have a song called Rush that was nominated for the Grammys, and it's a timeless song. I wanted to build a name for that song with real problems. And the way I grew up, my grandfather had a pure water factory, and it's like a sachet water factory. And my grandmother and my grandfather, their house is the only house that had like a borehole in the whole estate. So people used to come and fetch water. So I grew up knowing a lot about not clean water and having to work hard to get water. It was a no-brainer for me to work with my team to be able to help people in that way. I don't want us to forget that there are still people struggling and less privileged, and it's a lot of work to be done in Africa. So that's my own way of like collaborating.
So sing the song for us.
It a rush, it a rush, well, it be much. Now got to make my tap, it a rush. There's no telling me time.
So the rush is water flowing.
Yes,
so it's strongly.
Like, in a rush, in a rush is like this grace flowing, this water is pouring, like this oil, everything pouring.
It's lovely. What was Rihanna like?
Amazing. Mm-hmm. I feel like I didn't understand that was happening until like, I'm like, you guys,
wait,
this happened. This is not like, it's not fake.
So were you just ranting, really?
Well, we're like friends when we sat down to speak.
And now you've processed it.
Yeah. My icon. She's the reason I was inspired to do this. She's my biggest inspiration. She's amazing. She's beautiful. She's kind.
Does she smell nice?
She smells amazing.
Give a piece of advice to young women listening to you now.
Okay. Young women listening to me now. Be confident, not with pride or with ego. Be confident as in like believe in yourself. Because the way we grew up, it's, you know, we always try to focus our confidence on other people's confidence in us. Let the confidence come from within you and always try to live in the present and believe in what's happening now.
Ira talking to Audrey Brown. Thanks for listening. This edition of Focus on Africa was produced by Charles Kitonga here in Nairobi, Bella Hassan and Stefano Kireke in London. Kanisha was the senior journalist on the team. dotting the I's and crossing the T's. And Danny Cox was our technical producer. Andrew Lombard and Alice Modengi are our editors. I'm Richard Kagoye. We'll talk again next time.
The world is facing a shortage of tradespeople. The metaverse can help solve that problem. With a virtual reality training platform developed by ForgeFX, aspiring welders can practice over and over. As a result, students learn the specialized skills they need to begin and advance welding careers. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast, and we're looking at this summer's Paris Olympics and Paralympics. Hosting the Games puts a lot of pressure on a city. This means hosting isn't quite as appealing as it once used to be. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.